Okay, it's December 19th, and David Cole and Steve McCool are interviewing Sid Frizzell.
So I think we just start at the beginning.
Start? Okay.
And how did you get interested
in the beginning, yes.
wilderness research?
I've had some contact with wilderness working for the Forest Service in 1960-61 out in Washington.
Oh, okay.
And so I was a little familiar with some of the Pacific Northwest areas, although it was a timber district that I was on. They never mentioned wilderness at all, but
they
there was
don't.
Some nearby that I was familiar with.
So this was a when summer job that you had?
No, it was a permanent position,
oh.
which I only kept for a year and a half or so, and then I bailed out and went back to grad school. And I came back to graduate school intending to major in ecology, forest ecology, back to the forestry school where I got my undergraduate degree. And did a little project on, got a fellowship from timber company, one of the Minnesota timber companies, and this was at the University of Minnesota. And went up in northern Minnesota and did some surveying of jack pine stands and site index and all that kind of stuff. Came back to campus and decided I would like to have something that got interested in recreation somehow. I had a course from Donald Duncan, who was a, mm-hmm. you know who he was.
Yeah, right, he was my
we later on percent. Went to University of Missouri right. as dean yeah. or director, I don't remember which. And I had just walked into his office one day and said, I'd kind of like for my master's thesis to do something dealing with ecology and wildland recreation or wilderness. And I think it was about 2 days later that he called me up and said, Bob Lucas from the lab was just over and saying he's got some money for some wilderness research that he'd be willing to give to a graduate student at the school. So I went and talked to Bob and got set up, wrote a proposal to study the impacts of use on campsites in the Boundary Waters canoe area, which I had at that point not really canoed in before. I'd been up Grand Marais and up that road to the end.
Flint Trail.
And I think I'd been to Ely before, but I'd never canoed in them. So I spent a summer, maybe two summers, I don't recall.
What year was that?
That would have been 1963 or 64.
Okay, actually, earlier, because your thesis is 63, which I actually have a copy of.
Or 61, 62, then, yeah. maybe.
So you said that you went in and asked Donald Duncan, if there was anything in wilderness. Were you specifically interested in wilderness?
Wilderness or outdoor recreation or any wildland recreation, anything like that I could apply ecological interest to. And he didn't know anything at the time. He said, I haven't heard of any places where you could get any money. And
2 days later.
2 days later it popped up. So it was pretty fortuitous.
Mm-hmm.
But that project was designed to try to figure, get a hold of how much impact people are having on wilderness, particularly in the areas of campsites, which is the place where, in the Boundary Waters, where most of the impact occurs. They don't have many trails, few mm-hmm. portages, but most of the impact was on the campsites. So I went around and visited a bunch of campsites and interviewed a bunch of people, as well as taking measurements on the site changes, comparing on-site and a similar area adjacent off-site that was not damaged mm-hmm. or changed.
And to what degree was studying campsites in the Boundary Waters your idea or Lucas's idea or Duncan's idea? I mean, how specific was
I think Bob, the early suggestion about funding was fun to do something in the Boundary Waters, I believe.
That would make sense.
Yeah, for the Lake States station, there wasn't much else with a lot of wilderness to deal with at that time.
Or even, say, recreation.
Yeah.
Do you think Bob was specifically interested in ecological impact work, campsites?
Well, he at least accepted my idea. Mm-hmm. He's a social scientist, and most of the work he had going on was social science oriented, but that started my relationship with him. He moved out here a couple of years later, and I followed him a couple of years after that, and we continued having getting funding through him and cooperating on several other projects too. The other thing I did that was wilderness related but not done in wilderness was a study for my PhD dissertation on the history of fire and the role fire played in Itasca State Park, which is the headwaters of the Mississippi River. Some guy named McCool helped me on that a little bit. One, I never did remember how you got into that, but you were there, I know. Did help for a while.
Yeah, right. I don't remember either.
You remember the mosquitoes?
That must have been 65.
Yeah, when that's
we
about
did that.
Right.
Yeah.
I left in 67.
Yeah.
All the work was done, but I hadn't finished writing.
You and I were on my first trip into the Boundary Waters. Mm-hmm. Remember that disastrous camping trip we had with the wind and the rain and my little dog?
Oh, yeah, I guess I do remember. I'll just put it out of my mind.
66, yeah.
But
okay,
That study went pretty well. I based it out of the one in the Boundary Waters. Based it out of the wilderness, I forget what it was called, the Wilderness Lodge that was an inholding that the guy that owned it was a well-to-do fellow that was interested in the research programs about the wilderness. Yeah. Hubachek, his name was.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Hubachek.
And so I got involved with the fire history studies at Itasca, which in a way evolved into wilderness because Bud Heinzelman from the North Central Station, or Lake States, whatever it's called now. His study picked up where mine left off and moved over into the Boundary Waters canoe area and did similar work. And I spent a week or so with him a couple times.
Mm-hmm. So Bud took the techniques that you were using?
Yeah, he used similar techniques and then broadened it considerably and got much more in depth and a bigger area and more intense mapping. But I think I was pretty close to having the first fire history study that you can find in the literature. People had done dendrochronology work with test cores from trees to age the past history of an area, but climate and precipitation patterns and drought patterns in the Southwest particularly, where they'd done a lot with ponderosa pine. But I don't recall that I found any references that anybody had done that to study fire scars and fire history. So maybe I scooped everybody on that one. I'm not positive, though. There may have been some work that I didn't find. But
so what led you to study that in particular in that particular place?
What led me to that?
Yeah.
Well, that was Itasca Park is where the forestry school had a field station. So there was housing there, and it was a fairly virgin stand of old growth red pine with lots of fire scars, quite an extensive fire history. And they occasionally took down a tree along the road that was in danger of falling, and when they did, they cut a piece out of it for me to use to analyze the years in which fires had occurred in the past. So I was able eventually to map the frequency of fire and the distribution within the park. and showing the relationships between existing stands and the fire that created them, both the young red pine stands and brush fields and other kinds of habitats that occurred. So that's why I picked Itasca Park. It was convenient more than anything, and it was had a good stand of trees that hadn't been logged and hadn't changed and hadn't lost many of them. Then when I was finished with the field work but not yet written the thesis, took all my preliminary exams and took a job in Missoula at the university. Larry Miriam, who had been at the University of Montana in outdoor recreation, moved to Minnesota to the University of Montana, and 2 years later I came out and took his job out here. I got the better deal, I think, but he got more money from
yeah.
me. But very soon after I got out here, I think I spent some time talking to Bob, and I had a graduate student come along, Alan Jubenville, that was interested in wilderness research. So we got a project going for him. I think that was the first thing I did out here, was studying visitors to the Spanish Peaks. Oh, no, not Spanish Peaks. It was the Spanish Peaks. Yeah, that's right.
So Alan Jubenville was involved in that?
Who?
Alan Jubenville was involved in
Yes, that was his PhD dissertation.
So can we just go back just a little bit to Minnesota? Because while you were doing the work in Itasca, and about the same time that Hank Larry came out, there was funding to do more campsite impact study. That was the trip that you and I and Tim Knopf, we were on the first, you went with us on that first trip. You remember, we paddled, that's the one that was a really terrible trip, paddled up the Kuishwe River.
I don't remember that trip very much.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I know you went in there with...
We went into like Bald Eagle Lake whatever other lakes that were up there. So at some point, and I can't remember if Larry was there. This would have been 66.
He wasn't around when I did that study in the Boundary Waters.
Okay, the first one, right? But I'm talking about in like 66. So he may not have come out in right when that started, because you must have been like the principal investigator or something like that.
I don't recall another project on campsites other than the one I did.
Tim Knopf and I. Okay. I mean, I remember this trip. It was my first trip canoeing.
Yeah, yeah.
And the three of us went up, paddled up the Kuishwe River.
What was he studying?
We were studying campsite impact.
Campsite impact, oh, okay.
So we did, that was 66 and 67. First,
yeah, I guess by that point I was 66 and 67. What do you mean?
It was two summers long, the whole study. Yeah. But you were there for the very first trip that we took.
Yeah, I left about Christmas of 67.
Okay.
Here. Okay. Yeah, I don't remember.
You don't remember any of the details.
I was involved at that point in my.
Okay.
Work at Itasca, so I don't have any, and didn't have any involvement with the other.
You must have gone along with us because you knew the Boundary Waters.
Yeah, I remember that Tim Knopf had a study going of some kind, but I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
I don't remember ever seeing anything published about it. Is there?
Not really. Well, a little bit. Yeah, I think a forestry research note. I can't even remember.
Now. Yeah, the study you did up there was the first campsite study, and then Steve did, there was some sort of inventory of campsites up there that I think Steve was doing, and then the main thing that Larry Merriam did was, or thing that there was a series of reports on, was where he created new campsites and saw how rapidly they deteriorated. So it sounds to me like Bob Lucas gave Duncan some money for you to do a study, and you did that there, and Duncan advised you on that, and that's the only thing that Duncan ever had to do really with with this. And so then Larry Merriam showed up. Bob, do you think the money for the project you did also came from Larry Merriam?
From Bob?
From Bob?
Oh, yeah.
Through Larry Merriam?
Yeah, right.
So then there were a series of later ones.
I'm sure that's where that money came from.
The campsite inventory was the second one, and then the kind of experimental campsite was the third one.
I didn't have any involvement with that at all.
You were gone.
I didn't know anything about it.
That was the spring, because I set up all the campsites. So I did it in the spring. I flew around.
You had better trips than what you had the first time.
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. The pilot was this crazy Korean War Marine veteran. At any rate, so that was either the spring of... That had to be the spring of 68 when that was set up.
Gone.
So you were gone. Yeah. Yeah.
And you didn't have any knowledge of really any of the other studies that Bob was involved with, or some of the early sociological work that Taves and Donald Stone.
I remember that I read it, but I don't remember much about it.
Yeah, okay.
No. Take care of the dog in the middle of the
interviews.
That didn't work. Bugs, come on. Come on.
Now, Bugs, we have to get him to sign a release.
There's a way to pause that.
The study I did in Atascosa Park was funded by federal McIntyre Stennis money given to forestry schools for support of research. And I didn't have any Forest Service money or anything dealing with that.
So did you think about doing, after you did the first study in wilderness, trying to get funding to continue to work in wilderness? Were you interested in doing
a contract with Lucas again is just very soon after I moved out here.
Okay.
I moved out here in the winter, and I guess I didn't... Jupinville was my first graduate student, I think. And that was probably in 68 or 69. And so I did... And then the next one I was involved with that I can recall was Bill Gabriel on a fire history study in the Bob Marshall. And that was, I believe, funded by Lucas as well, by the Forest Service.
But after you moved here, you didn't do any more work in campsite impacts.
Yeah, you did worked in the Spanish Peaks.
Oh.
Yeah, I did in the Spanish Peaks, that's right. I inventoried virtually all of their campsites and classified them. Okay. And after that, some other grad students picked up on things from Bozeman, MSU, and followed up on some of those at work.
Do you know that there's the name Frizzell is used all over the place for all kinds of... campsite.
The campsite.
Usually, it's the modified.
Yeah. The campsite inventory system, classifying the condition classes. Pretty simple. Yeah. I wrote a Journal of Forestry article about it. Meaning, this was just. I figured this was something to get people started in inventorying. Nothing very fancy. And I got a call from Dick Joy, who had been in the Regional One office and had moved to Washington in wilderness management, asking if it would be all right if they distributed it to training sessions and people all over the country. And I said, sure, go ahead. And so now I can't go anywhere and talk to Forest Service people. They say, Frizzell, are you the Frizzell method?
Yeah.
Went down to the Medicine Bow to do a management plan review with the 3 or 4 other university people from around the country. And that was the first thing they said when I walked in the room. Just kind of interesting.
So let's see. So circling way back, you know, when you were growing up,
I grew up in New Hampshire, all the way up through junior and high school, and spent a lot of time outdoors. I lived in smaller cities. We were always out in the woods, hiking and messing around. So I had an outdoor interest for sure. I don't think I knew what wilderness was, but I knew there was the White Mountain National Forest and that it was more wild than the rest of the state. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Hopkins, Minnesota in 59 and finished my last year of high school there. And that's when I got familiar with. I had at that point, as in high school, on my own, I had read Sigurd Olson's books. Sigurd Olson was an old time very effective advocate for wilderness protection, particularly in the Boundary Waters canoe area.
Right.
In fact, John Duncan and I met Sig at his little writing cabin in Ely. Mm-hmm. And interviewed him about the study and asked him about what he thought about the changes that had occurred, and got some interesting contact. A little bit earlier than that, there's an interesting story. Bob Lucas had a meeting with Forest Service people from the Superior National Forest to find out what interest they might have in wilderness research and what kinds of subjects might be interested. The supervisor at the time, and I forget his name.
The big guy.
Yeah.
Smoked cigars.
John.
John. Starts with a W.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was definitely not particularly interested in wilderness because he sat in the corner and kind of lurked and watched, and then finally he put up his hand and he said, I got a good suggestion. We're having a lot of trouble with the concrete bases on the outhouses cracking in the winter. You guys can do any research on that? Uh-huh. Well, that wasn't quite what Bob was looking for, I don't think.
John,
but it was a great story. I mean.
John Warnham? No, that's not quite right. It's close.
Yeah. Something, it was the W, I think.
Yeah.
Anyway, he wasn't particularly oriented towards wilderness. Of course, the Boundary Waters wasn't even a wilderness then, I don't believe. It was a roadless area or something.
Well, the Wilderness Act didn't pass until 1964, which is after your thesis was done. Was there, I guess, one of the other sort of questions that we have here is, and I mean, this was the case with Bob Lucas, he sort of started working in the Boundary Waters because he really liked the Boundary Waters, and then at some point in time you realize, you're working on something that is unique to some degree in that it's wilderness. I guess I wonder if you could expound on, was there a time when you thought about that and how that came about?
I'm not sure I followed you there.
So you were working in the Boundary Waters. Was there a period in time when you thought that work, and then you came and you worked in the Spanish Peaks, for example, so there... You've worked now in two different wilderness areas. You know, having worked in wilderness areas, I'm working on something that's different than if I had worked in some other...
I kind of considered this fire history study that I did for my PhD that also had great implications for wilderness areas. And then when Heinzelman came along and started doing his project, he demonstrated how valuable that was. And I began to read about other fire history work being done around the country in wilderness areas. And, of course, one of the main reasons I moved out here, I had an instructorship at Minnesota. I could have stayed there on the faculty. But I took the job right away when it opened up because I was interested in getting out where there was more wild lands and mountain wilderness. I had spent 2 summers in the West, one of them on the Fremont National Forest as a student trainee, as an undergrad, and then after graduation, about a year and a half on the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest, just south of Mount Rainier. And so I guess I kept that interest all the way along in doing things that were related to wilderness areas.
So, Sid, the fact that a study was like the Spanish Peaks of roadless area, I think, when you came out, I can't remember now, but was the fact that was going to be in a roadless area or wild area or proposed wilderness, was that appealing?
To tell you the truth, I don't remember why I picked, I got into the Spanish Peaks, that one was picked. I really don't know whether Lucas had an interest in that area, or I don't know, may have been controversial at that time or something about the area, whether it should be classified or not. I don't recall.
Yeah, it may be because Bob was, Perry Brown and John Shoemaker did something there on campsites, and Bob and George had worked there. It may be that Bob was trying to get a whole bunch of things done in the same area. I'm not sure.
Well, that was the study in the Bob Marshall. Let's see, the user study down off the East Fork of Bitter, the Anaconda Pit, Dubinville study, and then the Bob Marshall study, and then my work in the Spanish Peaks. That was the last of any field research that I was involved with. But then there was quite a few more years of involvement with Bob Lucas and George Stankey and you and several other people at the lab on various concepts where Lucas and Stankey, both being social scientists and wanting to get something in these concepts of limits of acceptable change and things that were biologically based, they would fortunately came to me and asked me to be involved, so I was lucky enough to be able to continue that. Oh, the one other field type activity, George and I were invited to come down to Yosemite National Park and do some review and commentary on their master plan. And so we went down, and it was George Stankey, me, Irv Zuby, who was a landscape architect from University of Washington. University of Arizona. Yeah. And another guy from University of Washington, Bob Lee, a sociologist. And George and I had been doing a lot of talking and working around with this limits of acceptable change concept. And so it just happened that just seemed to fit. What they needed was a way to determine what was going on and whether it was too much here and there's too much use there or what. And we kind of brainstormed our way into that. The Park Service sat there like they were watching a ping pong game. They thought we had planned this all out, but George and I completely freewheeled it. It was probably the best meeting that I ever was involved with. We just clicked on that, and every idea, I would throw out an idea and George would pick it up, or Irv Zuby would pick it up, and it would evolve into something more, and then it just grew terrific. And the Park Service didn't try to interfere. They let us go, and they were very interested in what was happening. But it's been, I don't know how many years now, 20 or 30, since we did that, and I understand they're still struggling with their master plan. But my son tells me that he hears that they're still aware of that study, ideas that we put implanted. So maybe, I guess, we planted a seed. But that was, I also remember that as probably the best committee work. And I had a lot of committee work at the University of Montana. That was just a great experience. The ideas just came out. What about if we tried this? Yeah, that would work. And then we could do this and this. And that applies to these limits of acceptable change concept like this. And so it just rolled right along. And it was really fun to do. Mm-hmm. But... And we talked about the possibility of trying that same approach on a couple of other areas, maybe a wild river or a wilderness, Forest Service wilderness area, but that never materialized.
Well, to some degree, applying in developing what became the limits of acceptable change process, and then applying it on the Bob Marshall Wilderness, was that to some degree, I guess.
Yeah.
Am I blocking your wife out here from getting in, or?
She can park right there.
Okay.
There's room to park there.
Well, what are there things that came out of the wilderness research that you did that, what are the sort of conclusions and ideas that you think were, I mean, maybe aha moments for you, or particularly meaningful?
Well, I certainly developed an appreciation for the fact that people were having an impact. The Boundary Waters had campsites that were really in severe abuse condition. And I think I first appreciated that right there in that area, right in Minnesota. And I guess I brought that along with me, but I don't recall, but there may be one or two campsites in the Spanish Peaks that were as bad as some of those campsites in the Boundary Waters. But the Boundary Waters big groups, huge groups of people would go in there. 15 or 20 at a time. There were no limits. There were no registration to go in, no control. And so very large canoe parties, half a dozen, 6 or 8, 10 canoes, mm-hmm. and a bunch of people. So they really beat campsites. And it wasn't hard to not, would have been difficult not to draw the conclusion that this was not a positive effect on the country. That somehow we have to, one options that were available is to don't let anybody in, which probably wasn't very viable, and control people rigidly, and that wasn't the best possibility. And figuring out ways to minimize the damage and still let people have a good experience, but not let the damage spread all over the place. Try to keep it confined.
Hello.
Hi, Mickey.
Be careful what you say, we're being recorded.
I figured that was how you would work that.
Well, I was looking back today through the thesis. I mean, in many ways it seems very obvious, but that having no impact is not really an option, and therefore what we need to do as managers is decide how much impact is acceptable and manage for that acceptable limit rather than no impact at all a really important
The Superior idea. National Forest later really did develop some very extensive and intensive people management programs with reservations required and permitting and minimizing the impacts of some by not allowing excess numbers of people on any particular canoe route. They, I think, did a pretty good job of trying to get a hold of that and still allow free use.
I think, you know, this notion of the acceptability coming out from that work is still something that is, no matter how many times it's discussed, it's still something that people have a hard time wrestling with. They're not framing the question in this particular way. I still talk with people who say, well, we got to prevent impact. And it's just, okay, and it's like, well, you've got to think about this.
I really enjoyed working on the limits of acceptable change concepts that Lucas and Stanky, maybe George mostly, worked up. It was a very kind of a sophisticated approach, but it was practical. It said there's going to be change. It didn't say the limit was no change.
Right.
It's going to be change. How can you decide what's acceptable and what isn't? And that's the way we applied it in Yosemite was, what are the costs going to be if you don't do something? And they had plans to build more parking lots and do all kinds of things that would have all been negative impacts. And they had to make a decision at some point, and I don't know if they've made it yet, but of how much they were going to change Yosemite.
So do you want to ask something about the collegiality atmosphere just around there? Because you're interested
what collegiality?
So my perspective on wilderness management work unit, primarily, I think, in those early days, that it was, Bob and George and Dave worked or stimulated a lot of work.
Yep.
And they provided some money, but I think they also, the way in which they did this, and I just wondered about your feeling.
I definitely agree with that. The development of the wilderness project there at the lab was the first one, I believe, in the country. So it was a terrific model for, and it did stimulate work all over the country.
Right.
Like you said, Perry and others in Colorado were, at the time were doing wilderness work and
around the world too.
It seemed like whatever the model was, and I don't know, you know, if this was an explicit decision or how that kind of came out. But, you know, there were all the recreation research projects in other stations. And at least in my view of things, that what happened at the Missoula lab was much different than what happened in a lot of the other recreation research.
It was definitely wilderness related.
Yeah, wilderness related.
Just
but it's this
recreation.
Whole way of working with peers and seemed like it was much more productive than some of the other recreation research.
There were a lot of recreation studies of all types, from PE programs related user studies to...
Yeah, I wonder to what degree it was partially the fact that wilderness is new, so we're developing a whole new sort of subject that's being worked on, so and then, you know, the center for support for that, the people who can be spending their entire working days, you know, thinking about this stuff, what's happening here in Missoula. And then the other thing that was different back then, certainly than it is now, is to a substantial degree, we were working in a more focused area, and we were working together on things. So there's a lot more synergism and building than sort of what has been going on lately.
That project and the work we were doing resulted in my developing a wilderness management course for students in forestry. We had a recreation major. And but there was no course dealing with wildland recreation. So I taught a wildland recreation course that covered all kinds of lands, and also a wilderness course, which, if I remember right, Bob Lucas taught part of. I forget whether that was a guest lecturer or whether he was, but it was a major involvement for a year or two anyway.
Yeah, I remember George telling me, I don't know if he ever mentioned it to you, David, that occasionally there were these glitches that they couldn't accept any funding, any money for teaching.
Yeah.
So the university would buy him, what, typewriters or something? I can't remember what the piece
I
of equipment was.
I don't remember that. It could be.
And I know George taught in that the successor, anyhow, to what you were doing, and Bob had done that as well.
And Bob Ream, by the time I showed up in 78, Bob Ream was teaching a wilderness management course there. And, of course, Bob Ream also worked for Bob Lucas back in Minnesota briefly.
Yep. That's right. He was on one of our canoe trips, too. Yeah. First time we heard wolves howl. Bud Hanselman and I heard wolves quite frequently on them. Probably his.
Well, is that much of what we want to do? Should I turn this thing off?
Yeah, then we can get to the real.
That's all I really